Hello and welcome. Thank you for joining us. My name is Ben Wilder, Director of the Desert Laboratory. I'm speaking to you from Tumamak Hill, known in Atam as Chimamagi Duag, Horned Lizard Mountain, on the ancestral lands of the Sabaipri and Dona Atam peoples. This volcanic hill is of prominent ancestral, cultural, and sacred significance to the Atam nations, including the Dona Atam Nation, Gila River Indian Community, the Salt River Pima Maricopa Indian Community, and the Akchen Indian community, as well as the Hopi tribe and the Pasco Yaqui tribe. The Desert Laboratory recognizes the cultural significance of Chimamagi Duag as the bedrock of our institution and our future actions. This lecture series is celebrating the creation of the new Tumamak Resilience Garden, which we'll be creating the basins for in the middle of this coming month of March here in 2022. So this lecture series, Planting the Seeds for Tomorrow, is connecting you to the inspiration for this new garden space, as well as the creators that are really bringing it to life and inspiring it, both conceptually and hands-on, to really help you all envision this space, but also understand what we're trying to accomplish in its creation. The garden space we are creating is based on and will bring to a life a number of different knowledge systems and approaches to growing plants in an arid environment. In the first lecture of this series, we learned from Aaron Reardon and Gary Nabhan the conceptual underpinnings of arid America, a region with an incredible diversity of wild crop wild relatives and ecological interactions, such as the nurse tree concept, that form the literal overstory of the garden for the food plants that will grow below. We then heard from Brad Lancaster how we can capture the rainwater we receive in the desert, especially in an urban setting, to sustain gardens of arid adapted food plants with the rain we receive in our region, and how we will be doing so at this site. The plants we will be growing in this garden have long associations with people, which continue vibrantly to today and tomorrow. We are very fortunate to have Megan, Sterling, and Ruben with us today to share their perspectives. As we were talking in the preparation for this presentation, the four of us quickly arrived at the fact that there's not a straightforward way to communicate the great cultural connections to the land and plants encompassed by indigenous agriculture, and that there's no single answer or perspective that represents a culture, in this case, Atam agriculture, and that there are many important elements to consider before perhaps even talking about the plants or ways to grow them. So accordingly, this presentation will be a conversation amongst us to begin to talk about the cultural importance of agriculture on the very lands where the Desert Laboratory resides and where the Chimamak Resilience Garden will be. So to begin this conversation, Ruben Chukbak, whom I will formally introduce along with our other speakers shortly, will read his poem, Seeds of My People. Ruben, welcome, and thank you for sharing this work. You're still muted, Ruben.
There you go. Okay, thank you, Ben. Seeds of my people. In the soils of these lands, I am my ancestors. In the soils of these lands, I am fed beyond my stomach. In the soils of these lands, I am connected to the balance that is me. In the soils of these lands, I am the beat of Mother Earth's heart. Food sovereignty. It continues to be the war on me. Food desert, but there's always been food in the desert. I became fat when they took our food and water living away. They took my food and water thinking away from me. But the seeds were planted in Autumn Humiduck by Iitoi, so I am okay. I am the connection of past and future. In the fields, I grow in the songs. In the fields, Humiduck philosophies are planted. In the fields, I am harvested. In the roots of ancient foods, I don't exist in trauma. In the roots of ancient foods, I don't live in resistance. In the roots of ancient foods, I am healing. I am today. I am tomorrow. I live in Autumn Humiduck. I live in peace. I live in my power. I live in the food of the soil, healthy in the presence of my ancestors. Thank you.
Thank you, Ruben. So Ruben Chukbak is a traditional Atam from the Dona Atam Nation. He has lived, as he says, the Rez life and has been through various institutions and systems. Ruben consistently helps people learn to live a life away from addiction and violence and takes stories of his lived life and weaves them into his poems. Ruben is currently working on a collection of poems and insights that will be in his first book. Ruben, thanks for joining us. Also joining us is Sterling Johnson. Sterling Dona Atam is farm manager and farm mentor at the Alho Center for Sustainable Agriculture. Sterling was born and raised on the Dona Atam Nation in a ranching and rodeo family and is an accomplished bull rider himself. Sterling is a graduate of the former Dona Atam Community Action's Beginning Farmer Program and has continued the teaching to develop a new youth and adult education program in Ajo and on the reservation through his work with the Ajo Center for Sustainable Agriculture. He currently farms 2 dry land fields and 3 urban market garden, he currently farms 2 dry land fields and 3 urban market gardens farms, teaches weekly classes in 2 high schools, and has overseen 22 farming apprentices and 22 youth interns over the past 3 years, 70% of whom are Dona Atam. Sterling has extensive experience in marketing of traditional Native American crops and other local crops and products, and working with Native and other producers. Building on the 8 years of experience with the Ajo Farmers Market, he is one of the leads on developing the Atam Farmers Market. Sterling, it's an honor to have you with us. Also joining us is Megan Lopez. Megan comes from the small community of Newfields, Arizona, on the Dona Atam Nation at the edge of the U.S.-Mexico boundary. Megan shares, "I am passionate about Dona Atam lands, understanding how to help preserve and retrieve traditional agricultural practices, preserve the sacred knowledge, maintain ongoing life of our language and traditions that have been held valuable, and I am passionate about learning everything I can, as well as sharing my own experiences." Megan holds a Bachelor of Science degree in the Family Studies and Human Development from the University of Arizona and works full-time as a teacher aide in the Special Education Department at Tucson Hassan Preparatory and Leadership High School, a bicultural public high school designed for all Native nations, saying she is honored to be a part of a team of individuals who foster our traditional history alongside contemporary curriculum. She also works as a gardener's assistant for the Friends of Tucson's Birthplace at Mission Garden in Tucson, noting, "I started as a volunteer 3 years ago and began to form a strong connection to this amazing and resilient space, a strong resonance of my own childhood. My personal bond with cultivating plants comes from experiences and memories of my grandpa and his gardens. I enjoy planting and raising everything we have in Mission Garden. I especially enjoy learning from the board, co-workers, and the community." Thank you to the three of you for joining us and sharing your time and your knowledge and perspectives. So to begin this conversation, I want to start at, what does agriculture and food sovereignty mean to you? Megan, if you don't mind kicking us off.
Hi, good afternoon. Thank you for that nice introduction. For food sovereignty, the question starts with how is it defined by me? And it's an ability to have free will over how you eat, where your food comes from, and the ability to grow your own food, have access to your own food, and to be able to just thrive off of your own resources. And that can be food, medicine, water, and have the freedom to do and take care of those things. Food sovereignty for what I have experienced in the past, it doesn't exist anymore. There had been a time when our people lived all throughout these lands, all throughout the desert lands, and cultivated and harvested annually, seasonally, and it changed very drastically to where we're dependent on one grocery store, one gas station store, and the food in it is killing us and at a fast rate. And not having the knowledge in the past that we've had is detrimental. There's a divot in our ability to have sovereignty over our bodies, our being, our physical, our emotional, our social states. And what I had hoped, or what I hope through the work we're doing, is that we get back to that sovereignty, that ability to have freedom to eat how we want to, how we should, and how it sustains our body, learning from how it affects us in our body throughout, and our families throughout, and having those other huge pieces to who we are as Autumn, which is our culture, our beliefs, our practices, and passing these things down to our kids. So it's a lot of things, and it breaks down to more and more information and understanding than just the word, it's the two words itself. So I hope that gives a little bit of a clear answer.
Yeah, absolutely. And then help me understand where agriculture fits in connecting to food sovereignty as you defined it.
Well, we have this, if we have access to the seeds and we have access to the lands and access to the water and all the things that are equipped, that equip a farmer to have successful, you know, food resource, that is freedom. That is the free will to have these things and grow it for your own family and your own community, and do these successfully throughout new generations. That's something of a precious knowledge, something that we have to rely on as people from here, originally from here. And the, as you mentioned at the beginning, the land is very diverse. It's got all kinds of different foods and regions and mountains and valleys, and so the access is just innumerous. And if we had access to that good agriculture, then, and access to good lands, then that is agriculture and food sovereignty working into our new generation of kids and potential farmers and potential successful Autumn.
Yeah, no, thank you. That's really, really a wonderful way to think about that. Sterling, what would you add, or how perhaps you think about it in a different way?
No, sovereignty is something that is one. No, it's not a word in Autumn that you can define. You know, the language is very, it's different. It's very complex, especially maybe come from different parts of the reservation, or you're part of the brother and sister tribes where things are taught or said in a different way. And the way sovereignty comes down to me is how we define it, not but a government decides what sovereignty is. No, sovereignty is what, no, is equality for the Autumn people, because there has been people that have taken advantage of Autumn resources and not paying their for those knowledge. And it's one of those things that for us as Autumn people, we have never really taken in charge of and guided ourselves and value ourselves that way. That's not how we build Autumn life. Sovereignty was, for us, a way of life was to be able to grow food, have food as a community, as a villages, coming together. Passing that knowledge down to the next generation, and and having so, and also just having that resources or access to do those things. And that's, you know, for me, you know, sovereignty is something that people still don't understand. It's something that it's just a word, and to exercise our freedoms and to exercise those things, that's something that we're still learning to do. As far as, you know, teaching other people and teaching ourselves how to value our work to create equality, because on the reservation, there's only so many tribal opportunities to work on the nation, and it's hard to value, you know, your work if your work is more valuable off the nation than it is on the nation. And so then, for me, now, how do you bring two together? Now, how do you bring, or if you didn't do things on the nation, now, how do you teach people what sovereignty is? You know, and for me, I'm grateful that I get to do that by starting the Auto Market as OCC and as a collaborative effort with, between the districts and the other farming organizations to create those opportunities for autumns to see what's valuable and actually have access to, you know, cultural appropriate foods, but also bring new things into people's lives.
Thank you. That's great. And Ruben, what would you like to add before we move on to the next question?
The two concepts to ag and food sovereignty to me are, for the autumn at least, it's just a one thing. It's not, they just coexist. Like, everything's connected for us. So we don't really, kind of like Sterling and Megan were saying, it applies to everything, but to overall well-being of the individual, the families, the community, the health of the individual, the families, the community. But in terms of like the Western definition of the two, ag is crazy. Ag has been crazy for a long time. And even here in Arizona, where there's still lands that are fallow because of the DDDs that they used back when, you know, I mean, that stopped in 72, and still these lands they're fallow. You can't do nothing with them, you know? And then the overgrazing of ranchers have done so much damage to these lands. So I don't know. And then the monocropping and all that, like for me, and especially in Arizona, where they're growing things in Arizona that shouldn't be grown in the desert. And they're taking all this water. It takes all this water to grow all these crops that have no business in the desert. And it's just taking, and we suffer for that because they're taking our water resources from us. They've been doing that since they got here. It's nothing new to us. So then if you go into the food sovereignty, that definition doesn't even apply. It doesn't apply to us because the majority of our people aren't employed. The majority, they're on food stamps, welfare, where they have a limited source of income. And all they can afford is that processed crap you buy in supermarkets. They could learn what Megan and certainly would say, they could learn that. But in this assimilation process, they're so far gone from these concepts right now, like Megan was saying, that it's just kind of relearning this that will help us move forward in this direction. But again, these things are always taught. And like I was saying in my poem, like so much has come from just working in the fields with the community, laughter, songs, philosophies, all those things were cultivated in while we were planting, because so much is connected to that life. Because it feeds us and it gives us life as well. So there were songs for the sun, the water, the moon, all of it. So much comes from that we couldn't really define in an hour.
Well, there was so much that each of you said in response to that question. And I'll just pause here for our audience. You know, one of the benefits of doing this, while I wish we were all in person, one of the benefits of doing this remotely is that we can, you have the chance to pause and replay that. And I encourage you to do so, because there was a lot communicated in that short amount of time. So thank you all for that. You know, as the four of us were speaking in preparation for this lecture, you know, one of the topics we spoke about was that cultural information is appropriate to be shared and certain cultural information is not. And so the question is, you know, why is it important that some aspects of agricultural knowledge or cultural practices in general remain private and within Ottom communities? And Sterling, I wonder if you don't mind kind of starting us off and kind of, addressing that topic.
There's general things that can be shared. It's one of these, it's one of those things that become reused, but as far as, you know, now things that are secret, you know, for me, the medicine people come to mind, you know, those are the people that are, you know, very, you know, knowledgeable and, you know, and people just don't understand we live a different life. There are things in this world that people just will never understand because of our culture, because of our history, because, you know, songs and ceremonies, there's a lot that is there, and it really it weighs a lot on all of us, especially all of them that still practice, you know, culture or traditions and the way you do things. And, you know, for us, it's, you know, a way of honoring, you know, the same way someone goes to church, you know, that they're a devout Catholic or a Christian, they go to church because that's, you know, their space. That's the way they praise, you know, God, you know. For us, you know, even though it's just one aspect of what, you know, what is there, you know, there's other things that are there that, you know, probably some of us don't even know. And it's one of those things that, you know, within communities, it's hard to won't even share. Now, a silly thing for me, you know, I this is I'm going into food, and there's this thing called whisko churro, and how I got to there, and I don't know, but it's a Lebanese sweet bread that I got to taste in Washington, D.C. But now, how did that get there and then be incorporated into the culture? And the people are in the communities are known for having certain things or certain foods, and I can't get any information about it because people are guarding it, because, you know, people have been hurt, people have been abused. I was part of revitalizing the men's salt run back in 2013. And that was a very sacred time. And people, you know, there's communities that, you know, let non-natives be a part of the Sundance and take money for it. And those ceremonies are sacred, just like powwows. I don't go to powwows because, to me, that's a sacred ceremony that was, used to promote non-natives and cash in on Native American, you know, practices and traditions. And for us as people, that's not how we see ourselves. We see ourselves as, you know, as a Christian would, or as a Catholic, you know, as a Jewish person, you know, anybody that's a man of faith. You know, for me, that's where I see, at least for myself, that's how I a whole myself. So there's a lot of things I don't share with non-natives, but there's a little bit more that I would share with often people, because if they know just a little bit, they might take that responsibility to go ahead and learn more. But I can't force it down their throats. I can't lead them to that. Those things, they have to take that initiative and responsibility. And if they're pure of heart, or if they're really a person of conviction and wanting to get these done, they learn these things so that they can better themselves, then I will be here. Mm-hmm. No, but for me to give overall general information to people, no, I'm so glad that I'm able to do that.
Yeah. No, thank you. That's really illuminating. Ruben, how would you answer the address this topic?
Well, it's pretty simple. I think you have to respect what an individual is willing to share with you, period. And that's it. And not really question why. Why? Because there's another part, a component to a lot of things that traditionally, and I am traditional, so I understand, it's like there's a lot of things that are components of Autumn Hemaduck that you could not understand in Western thinking. It's not possible. And so and even for the Autumn that aren't traditional and are more Christian and what have you, it's even hard for them to understand what that is, because and you got to understand too, like the majority, like pretty much assimilated, you know what I mean? We grew up in these schools and academia, like higher education, all that. And you know, I have a BA, and so I did that whole track, but I was fortunate that I come from a traditional family. So there's just things that you wouldn't be able to see or understand in this thinking. And even if it's presented to you, and even if the knowledge was given to you, it's hard to really grasp it with that Western mindset. So that's another component of, you know, I talk with some of my elders, and they just get to the point where they don't even bother sharing some things with some people, because they know that they won't understand it. And so, like, it's the same with non-autumn. It's just that same thing. Like, if I told you, you might think I'm crazy or something. But again, it goes back to, like, there's a lot of things that we can't share. So,
Megan, what would you like to add?
Excuse me. Very similarly to both Sterling and Ruben, it's a form of respect to just be able to accept what an Autumn person is telling you, whether it be, I'm not going to share that with you, or, you know, it's also just a form of respect, and also accepting this person as a human being, that we have rights, that we have this unique life that we have, we're gifted, and it should be taken as understandable that we all live a unique life, and that we're just trying to live ours. And if that means we're living with the presence of mind, just like everybody else, just like you, we also have a sacred life, a protected life, a life that we're trying to foster and keep sacred. And if agriculture, and agriculture does fall into that space, and it's something that's been passed down since the beginning of time, and it's been insinuated as well as directly been told, you know, you take care of these things, or you take care of yourself, or, you know, things that are meaningful I can think of things my grandparents have told me, and things that I've had the ability to be a part of. And so I really thank both of Ruben and Sterling for explaining that, and from knowing from my own source of knowledge, you know, we're a patrilineal society. We look to the males for a lot of direction and support, and to, you know, step to a lot of what needs to be done, what the directions are of the community. And it's important that, you know, we all support each other and see that same direction of taking care of our plants, our home, our kids, our, you know, our family systems, our cultural systems. And so that's a big reason, I think, why it's important for non-Otham to understand that if they're being, you know, a part of something like our agriculture, you know, our planting time, or a prayer, or, you know, a talking circle, it's really important to listen, to just listen and not be thinking all the time of things that need to be asked, but just stop and listen. Because I run into a lot of that where people, they're already ahead of themselves and they're not in the space with me when we're talking about serious things. And that is just a really, you know, it's already dismissive. So it's a really important thing to just listen, be a part of what we're saying in the present moment, because we're trying to just do our best to honor ourselves in that way. So that's what I have to share.
Yeah, beautifully said. So important. Related to directly what you're saying there, and all of you contributed, you know, in terms of thinking about non-Otham when having conversations, and you or anybody we may be speaking with is sharing, you know, I think it's important to not ask inappropriate questions or probing questions or questions that are culturally insensitive, right? That are not recognizing, right, that there are limits to what you are comfortable or an Otham is comfortable sharing with a non-Otham. How would you encourage to ask, to think about, to encourage non-Otham people to ask questions that are culturally sensitive and recognize this gradient of appropriateness, right? Of what is a culturally appropriate question to ask?
Well, I mean, yeah, it's, and it's hard because that's a really hard question, because it's really, now for us Ottomans, we're very, you know, kind of like mean in a way to each other. But it's more like that. It's a cultural understanding, you know. And with the way kids are being taught now, it's very hard to convey that, especially when they're distracted by social media. No, TikTok and Snapchat and Facebook and all these other things. So it's really hard to convey. I find it tough because, you know, the assumption that, you know, Navajos and Apaches and Hopis are all the same. And I work with NCCC AmeriCorps groups, and no, I said something in Otham, and then this girl from Oregon, and then this girl from Connecticut, that was the supervisor, saying, "Oh, what is she? What did he say? What is he saying?" And the assumption that we speak all the same languages, that was the worst part. I think that's one of the things that, you know, people are just going to have to find their way not to be, it's going to be hard to find your way around an Otham, not to assume that that's how they're going to be. I had people that saying, well, we honor people and we feel like we're doing everything traditional. I'm like, well, not necessarily. I mean, you're saying you're doing it, but you don't do these things. The practices, for me, especially like when it comes to like smudging or stuff like that, people, our understanding is when someone comes and takes care of us, through the medicine people, we understand it that they're going to do it their way, versus no. I was there at an event where an autumn was smudging, and the person was like, oh, why didn't you come to me? Why did you come to me and smudge me? Like, there's entitlement. And I think that's the worst part, is that the assumption and entitlement that people think that natives are there for them to, you know, appropriate, or at least, you know, ask of, you know. And for me, that's one of the things that, at least from my point of view, what I have seen over the years, you know.
Yeah. Such key words, assumption and entitlement there. Yep. Megan or Ruben, anything you want to add on that, or should we move to the next question? Move on. All right.
I think it also depends on who's asking, because if, like, an elder Navajo, who's traditional in Navajo ways, he and I would talk about philosophies, things like that. We were talking about a lot of similarities between our tribes, and there's a lot. But then, if I had I've recently had a couple of PhD students ask me some stuff about autumn knowledge, and I had to go to a friend who is Dene, and she works in genetics, and so we came up with a list of questions to ask them. Who's your PI? You know, like, is there a review board? How is this going to be cited? And like, you really have to word those things in a way that structures that it contains, that it protects that knowledge. Because if you're telling it from your own point of view as the autumn, it's still autumn knowledge. If it pertains to anything that comes from my people. It depends on who's asking and how you said it. But generally it is kind of inappropriate to just start shooting questions at individuals about whatever, you know. It's there's a way to do it.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, switching gears a little bit. What do you enjoy most about working with plants and teaching others about them? So, Ruben, if you don't mind kicking that off for us.
Say the question again.
Sure. What do you enjoy most about working with plants and then teaching others about them? Or you can please expand that, I know, in terms of your work with plants and words, right? So however you want to address them.
Well, I remember working in the garden with my grandma when I was a child, and she would tell me things, and it was just that it was the physical connection to the soil, to the things out there, but it was also her presence. It was also like the day, it was like the laughter and everything that went in with it. It was this connection to something that you don't get outside of that. I mean, you get it in components, but it was just all there. So there's this connection to the process of learning. I remember learning from her, and then later on I haven't practiced any of that for a long time, and then I started learning again. Sterling showed me some things, and Megan showed me some things, and other people showed me some things. So it's just getting that connection back. That's what I really like, is that connection to Mother Earth and to all of it. It's just, there's something in that you're not going to get anywhere else.
Megan, I know as you read in your intro, and we had the pleasure to work with you over the summer on the Desert Monsoon Senses when you shared with us about Shugi and creosote, and your connection to that plant in particular, which is so palpable. You know, how about for you in terms of how you enjoy most working with plants and sharing them?
Similarly to Ruben, I grew up, my grandpa, it's like the greatest ever. He would start me early in the morning at 4 years old, you know, taking care and tending to his plants around his house, and just being active and being involved, I think, as raised just by myself a lot, no other kids around, and it was just me and him. And we would take these long drives and check on plants out in the fields. And I went away from that as well for a while. And then just recently, through my work at Mission Garden, starting off as a volunteer, walking into Mission Garden, it's just like this overwhelming feeling of memory, just waves and waves and waves of memory, and this like direct connection to the smells, to the size of the trees, to the colors, and the overwhelming sense of energy in the whole space. And that's what it was like being around my grandpa all the time. And now working there for several years now and doing my own planting and encouraging others at Harshan to get into the planting and talking about it constantly and just thinking, how do I relate this in a way that people find it enjoyable? Because a lot of people's with students, it's like, it's hot. What are you doing out here? It's hot. And finding that enthusiasm at my level. And it's all of these memories, all of these just constant, like, great feelings of energy being around my grandfather and having this ability to create, to raise and tend to life, to these little things that rely on you for everything. And you get to watch them in succession, these almost like fast forward time shots of plants growing. It's that majestic feeling of like, whoa, things are happening. And it's a great feeling, you know, it's a wonderful feeling to have that and have something to look forward to getting up with the sun and being out there and hearing things that you just can't hear in the city, and experiencing that kind of resiliency of nature happening, and you're just lending your hand in. That's a great opportunity for anybody to have and raise plants. And teaching kind of comes with the history of where we're at in Mission Garden, and also where I come from. They come hand in hand because I come from a whole other part of the Thaunatham Nation, and I have this opportunity to talk about the history of this area and what's been lended down from our ancestors to now, and this critical moment to continue, and having that energy to do that. You know, it's all very important work that all of us are doing. So that's a little tiny snippet of what I enjoy.
Yes to all of that. It's just wonderful. Sterling, for you, how about for yourself?
For me, it's, I've been teaching people for 25 plus years. It really hasn't. For me, it's one thing that has always kept me going, doing horse camps, doing German rodeos, doing competing myself, but also happy that opportunity for kids to and young adults to do that. That's the portion I grew up with, and it wasn't until 2011 when I actually started growing food, and that was probably one of the things that was a big learning experience for me, because it was one thing that people people did this without machinery, people did this without shovels, and how was it done? And then doing it a modern way, and finding enjoyment in that, and then finding culture, and then and the culture that's behind the foods, and then going off on my own learning a whole new thing and being able to teach that to where I'm at the point where I'm now, where No, I'm with the AHA Center for Sustainable Agriculture. We did this apprenticeship program where we first started, and it's continued because it's a need. And I'm grateful that other people are taking just finding enjoyment that other people are taking this on and doing this, being able to go to TOR High School and help them grow their field to be able to go to Kuwal in the next couple of weeks to help them out and revise their traditional fields. And I'll offer any expertise I have for them doing the work that I've been with dryland farming or auction farming or traditional farming. And yeah, it's enjoyment, for me. And I enjoy that, people from all ages, are learning this traditional foods, but also when they actually do it on their own, then they don't need me to come out and teach them. And they're all excited that I grew this and I grew that. We have one of our apprentices that lives in the village of Kolik. He shows him pictures every so often when I see him, but he grows his own trees and his own chilies. And there's times I stop by there, and there's a little kid in his diaper standing outside watering with the hose, and then just like, wow, that's realizing that's how it was done. No, not exactly how it was done, but being taught that when you're a kid, how to take care of a garden and being able to have that, to have those people do that at home and for their families, it's really inspiring, and it keeps me going.
Yeah, I love that. I love that visual, that mental image of that kid watering the garden.
Yeah.
Related to this general topic about plants, but getting a bit more specific. So, Megan, what are some of the plants, the individual species that you really enjoy growing or think are especially important to focus on when we talk about and really think about growing arid-adapted food plants?
I love all of them. I love a lot of just in learning, I didn't know a lot, and just learning about, like the squash and how it has these unbelievable huge flowers that they're honored in baskets and images and songs, and bao, the story of the bao and how it came to be. That's like one of my favorite things to mention. And it's hard to pick out of all the things that we have this ability to grow. And in fact, it's even hard to think of what's the best thing or favorite thing to harvest, because it's come to that point where it's survival, it's food for living, it's food for giving and for thriving off of, and to be contemplative of all the time. And just in sharing a lot of the foods this past year with a lot of people, it's really the manner of sharing all of these species that we grow at Mission Garden and at the school. And it's, of course, our main crops, the 60-day corn. I had the opportunity to grow leader corn that a staff member at Hashin gave me. She's Navajo as well. And she thought it was a good idea to start planting them. And they're beautiful, they're leader corn. And just talking about them with the students, it gets them motivated and interested in a very adventurous manner almost. They were willing to just see how these corns came out if they were gonna help me. So it's really the season that it gets me. The summer is the most It's like the most awesome time of the year for me. I love it. And I love it. One of the reasons is because a lot of people don't like it. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of people that really object and leave. And that's great. I love that because it's time for us to get deep involved with the season and dedicate our time and don't have to go into like specifics, you know, we just go and do, and it's almost innate to take care of all of these species that belong to the desert, and doing the right thing by the soil and by the water and by the seed itself, and just fostering all of them. The squash, the bao, the hoon, all of it, and the watermelon. I mean, come on, a yellow meat watermelon, everybody knows it, and they don't, you know, you have to spend a lot of time with yellow meat watermelon to really appreciate how laborious that work is. Mm-hmm. to wait on it and be patient, and that once you cut it and you share it, you know, all of that work is taken in, and it's gratifying and it's surprising, and it's really just the season, the summer, that really gets me. We get our rain, we get bythatch, we get all of these different things, so it's kind of hard to talk about species, but it's definitely in the umbrella of the season, the summer season.
You're making me excited for summer's arrival even more than I was previously.
Yeah, man.
Ruben, how about for you? Are there any, do you relate to any species in particular, or similar to Megan, do you think of it more at a seasonal level, or yeah, how do you come at that?
I really like the bao beans or tap-free beans if you want. I think their story is just, I was talking about this whole resilience thing, and to me, the bean itself isn't being resilient to anything. It's just its natural form in the desert, like us as people. We're not mad at anybody. I'm not trying to fight nobody. We're just being our natural selves and who we are. And it takes up this form. So again, the philosophies in these foods that tell us about us. And then I of course, I like the way they taste. I eat them every week. And those are my favorite that come from the garden, but the ones that Mother Nature grows are would just be spinach and bio-touch for me. Those are my two favorite out there. I mean, of course, Jordan, but yeah, that'll be it.
Great. Sterling, how about for you in the work you do in the gardens?
It's really I don't really have a favorite for me. I really enjoy that food comes in any shape and form, whether it's jorum or bidets or epi or, there's other things, but I keep that to myself that are out there. And it just, I like that it's, something that has been provided by the desert. And I think that's what I think about wild foods, because that's what I grew up on. Mm-hmm. If I wasn't picking it during the summer, then I was going, riding my horses, and I was, looking at what was growing. And for me, that's, nature's always been the telltale of how things are going to be for the season. And that was, and that was excited me when things are going to be ready, right now with this warm weather and coming up this March, and choy buds are going to be coming up pretty soon. The fact that it's only around for a short time, it for me is like, it's not like maple trees where you can get the extract and then cook it down and make it into syrup, and you can do that at any time during the season, and it's good for for a couple months. Now here it's 2 to 3 weeks at the most, and you have to enjoy it, you know. And if you don't get to enjoy it, you got to come back next year and do and see if you can catch it. But for me, that's what I like about, you know, I think just more like wild foods and then being able to grow traditional foods and getting to different varieties of new seeds, you know. And right now, I'm hoping to grow more of new seeds that we got last year. And just to try them out and see how they grow, more of it, and then be able to cook a meal with them. That's what I'm looking forward to as far as cultivation.
Very cool. The, you know, pivoting a little bit, can each of you speak some about how the Chumamaca Resilience Garden can be a learning environment for youth in particular, and thinking of creating this space here and how we can engage youth? Yeah, Sterling, what are your thoughts?
It's always a good, as far as, you know, for autumns, you know, and youth, you know, it's, it needs, we're at this point in our lives where we need to, you know, incorporate different things, as far as like growing. For me, you know, we're, you know, as long as the kids and students are at the schools are learning this, you know, there's an opportunity for people to take that initiative and continue to grow, grow the food. You know, for me, it's what this Resilience Garden can teach everyone is, you know, like it teaches a lot. That's why the Autumns have lived here for so long, you know. We have our ways of doing things, but no, there's this modern society that we live, you know, less than 60 miles away, that, you know, are just, you know, pushing things to its limits and figuring out what can be done. And that's what I find the enjoyment about being invited or going to other gardens. Not just to share what I share, but learning from others how these things can be done.
Yeah.
To me, that's, you know, and, you know, for me, you know, there was a reason why Autumns grew the way they grew, but we're learning more now. No, there's other ways to do things, and that's what I find enjoying. I grow stuff and raise beds, and I've done them with regular soil, I've done them with sand, I've done them with, you know, good soil, and there's, you know, so many combinations and things that I haven't tried yet, but I'm so great. I'm grateful that I'm able to do these things and then teach the next generation. Mm-hmm. So. But yeah, that's just me.
Megan, I'm curious, you know, especially with the experience you bring with at Hashan and at Mission Garden, you know, thinking about this new space here. Yeah, what would you encourage us, and what would you, could you see yourself and others doing, you know, especially to engage Autumn youth and other youths as well?
Shade, lots and lots of shade.
Yes.
Better make sure to have a nice Ramada for everybody. It's something that's coming up that's really critical, and it's always been this way, but at least for this like recent to future tense, the critical state of water and the situation we're all sitting in right now, as we're trying to wrap our heads around how much water do we really have access to, and who is controlling it, and how are we divvying it up, and is it like going to the right places? And chances are we won't get answers, and chances are there's answers that people will want to tell us and pander to us, but Those, like we had mentioned, a lot of the conversation prior in this session, it has a lot to do with integrity and respect and equity. And it's never been like that. You know, it's never, we've never had equity in this state for sure, and certainly within this region amongst people. And it's really important to continue that conversation on what compassion is and what it means to have equal resources and what that looks like, because I don't think I've ever really seen it. And what the history right there where you're at brings to the people visiting that space, if it's resilient, we got to learn, where are we coming from? Where are we at now? And where are we going? And the opportunity to access all kinds of food, another piece that is equitable to all people, if they're given that chance, that right, that, you know, people leaving that garden could potentially take a whole basket of corn and pass it out along the side of the roads to many people who are holding up hungry signs. Things like that are really, really important to humanity right now. And the youth in general are going to have their own youth someday. And do we have enough existential experience to encourage them to see beyond themselves and not to just take, and not care who was here or why things came out to the way they are, to work in favor of, to have privilege? It all needs to be discussed and redirected in another direction, have different value on resources. And that garden could very well resound the compassion of what it is to live here, you know, what we can access to if given the right, the chance, the equity and utilities, you know, learning how to make your own rope, learning how to have materials to break down so that you can utilize them in a way where you don't have to go to the store to buy Tupperware or plastic or, you know, things. I don't even know if Tupperware exists anymore, but things that don't need to be rebought. And yeah, just it's kind of limitless at the same time I'm making these lists out, but there's just so many things. And if it's resilience that we're seeking out, then there should be the philosophies of what that is to all the diverse people here in Tucson, because they have their own story as well as the Ogden people. And it deserves to have, similarly to what we're all striving for, survival and the right to live with food in our belly and things that we need to keep going.
Well, so much there in your words. Yeah, thank you. That's powerful. Ruben, you want to add anything in terms of how we can engage the youth in this space?
Yes. I love what Megan shared. And I agree that if the word resilience is going to be in there, because I really don't like that word, but if you're going to use it, then there has to be some kind of education, maybe bulletin boards inside of what's happening with our water, what's happening with the land, what's happening with our air, things like that. They're going to impact these things, because the food itself is just a natural process of the desert. It's not resilient. It's just, it's always been here. It's always going to be here. It's just living its natural life if it gets the water it needs. And even if it doesn't, some of those plants don't even need water for a while. But all I'm saying is that you have to educate them in that, in what's really going on with all of that, because if things keep going the way they are, there isn't going to be any water someday. And another part of that is, for me, I think teaching youth is always a good thing, teaching youth. But then you have to also teach the family, because if you teach something to that youth at that moment of time and they only hear it like once a week or once a month, and they go back home and their family is practicing different things, that's what I mean. If they're just a child and their parent is like, well, that's good for them, but this is how we do things in this house, kind of thing. It has to be taught in that, in to the family, to the house, to change, to make that change. That's the overall like goal, I would think, is to it's a system, a family's a system, and a child or the youth is the only one component of that. They could potentially bring that knowledge in and change the family. That's the hope. But usually it's the parents that are running the household. And depending on where their mindset is and how they live, that really has a big factor on how it's going to impact that child. Hopefully the child takes it to adulthood. So that's the hope.
Man, you each gave us so much to think about as we design the points of connection and how we're going to utilize this space to inform our community. That was just great. So as a last question, among a million others, I'm kind of jumping at the bit to continue to ask, but you know, what do you want those walking Chumamuk to learn and to observe, to learn, to connect with as they walk through this garden space, both when it's new and after it's been there a while and after it's become a familiar space? Let's start with Ruben. Kick us off there.
Gratitude and respect for themselves, for the life around them, and for the mountain itself, for everything. Just gratitude and respect.
Sterling?
Yeah. Especially, I never really gone there myself, so I don't know what's there, but you know, knowing that, you know, that we are still here, people, you know, and we are still going to be here long after I'm gone, you know. We're still going to be here. We're still going to be, you know, the people that have, you know, lived in the desert for, you know, thousands of years. So for me, you know, respect is one of the things that are, you know, is always important to me, because that's where, I feel like that's where kids, you know, and even everyone should know, even if our own people go up that area, understanding that, you know, the history behind it, understanding that, you know, even our own people will need to understand that that's not how things are grown, especially in, but understand, you know, wanting to get people involved in growing food and you know, educating people about, you know, growing food here in the desert or in their communities, because they don't have the lifestyle that we have. They don't have that access to land or that access to water. But what you do have access is to, you know, what you're in, you know, where you call home, you know, and it might be, you know, Oro Valley, it might be, you know, downtown Tucson or South Tucson or East Tucson, you know, but people will have access to, you know, this way of growing. That's why for me, seeing people growing the way they're growing, you know, it gives me inspiration to push what, you know, what, you know, growing fruit for me in the desert, you know, and what's possible, what's not possible.
Yeah.
So now for me, it's and I know, and people interpret it the way they want to interpret it. You know, that's the hard thing about for me, that's why it's hard for me to share my knowledge with people, because people have, you know, their own way of interpreting things, and sometimes it's the way you want it to be and sometimes you don't want it to be that way. But you know, that's where we, in the beginning of the conversation, you know, that's why, you know, we share, you know, there's a general information, but then there's information that we don't share. And so, but no, I'm hoping in the decades to come that things will be more open, things will more be compatible that, you know, our people will, you know, coexist. We coexist now, but, you know, it's a hard thing to coexist when, you know, you're in poverty and are given crappy food, and then you're in Tucson and you have access to, you know, a lot of the economy, to resources, to a lot of things that Aucklands are not so used to having available for them. So, you know, but no, here we are, you know, we're having this conversation, and I hope your students or your attendees, you know, take from this and learn, you know, with the little that we're given to share, you know, there's so much more. And, you know, we, all three of us, you know, are doing our own thing, you know, and I'm, you know, I'm glad that, you know, they're still doing what they're doing. Megan, Ruben, you know, everyone that's, you know, here, you know, and you guys as well, you guys are doing this, you know, you guys could have been just say, oh, okay, no, just, no, we're being difficult. Let's not do this, but you guys are taking time out of your lives to, you know, record this and piece this together and make it available for people to, you know, see us.
Okay. So, thanks, Sterling. Megan, how about for you? What are you hoping people connect to and take with them and observe in this new space?
Well, just the ability to be present. I think we've lost that, especially within the last 2 years, and forgetting that we're human beings first, and just really having the presence of mind that we all are just trying to belong and understand and have access just like everybody else, have opportunity just like everybody else, and that with enough patience, time, and support from the community, like these like what you're doing, you can learn that, you can have access to it, and you can share that, you can keep spreading that information and knowledge to go further. And I just hope that people understand, like, that they have more, they're afforded more ability to know where they're at, to understand the history, the real Tana'atham history behind what happened here, what came to be our presence and our present day, I mean. And it's very powerful, you know. There was a time where people didn't go up that hill or go around that, you know. People were very close, you know, close proximity to this part of town, you know, the center part of town to up northern part of town. And it, you know, it just got very populated. It got very diverse, and it got widespread with homes and people. And we forget that there, you know, there's coyotes that live out there. There's rabbits. There's javelina. There's things that coexist, that share a home there, just like everybody else. And that they should be afforded the right, just like plants and the rocks and the soil, the dirt. It all has a right to be there, just like everybody else. And if we keep kicking it to the side and shooting at these animals and just letting it decay, letting it find its own way, then we're not creating resilience around it. We're just pushing it out of the way and not thinking about the effects of true nature there. And that's my worry. And that's what I hope people understand, is that there's a history, there's a continuation of life that's there, and that we need to give space to it, you know. All things living, birds, you know, lizards, jumamok, you know, these things exist still, and just not to walk over them or take them or abuse them or do things that counterbalances with what I think we should be doing as people, as Autumn, as human beings, is give respect, like, you know, like Reuben said, give respect and integrity, and also give yourself respect, you know, like learn from just being mindful and being present and not be worried about the news all the time or what's going to happen and, you know, the economy, and, you know, it's all going to still be there, but we only have the moments that we're in. And if we have the spaces where we can meditate that and work towards that in a community setting, then that's really important. That's a very strong muscle to exercise.
Thank you. Yeah, I just want to echo Ruben's words in terms of gratitude and respect for each of you for taking this time to share this. I've learned so much. There's so much for us tangibly in the Desert Laboratory creating this new space. And I know for all of our listeners and people watching this, this has been really, really wonderful. So thank you for taking your time out of your days and for connecting and for the three of you to spend this time and energy with us. It's been wonderful. Cool. Well, thank you to our viewers. Thank you for joining us. And make sure to watch the preceding the lectures, the ones to come, and join us down at the base of Chumawak and see this space come alive. All right. Thank you all.
Good to see you guys. Have a good week.
Yeah. Take care.
To mute.